We are going to turn to Psalm 93, the Psalm for Friday, which is also part of Kabbalat Shabbat. It is, as you will quickly notice, extremely brief, but there's a bunch of things to talk about here. So we'll do our best to kind of unpack everything there is to unpack here, or at least I shouldn't say everything. I don't believe you can unpack everything there is to say about any text, but we'll unpack a lot, I hope. Okay. Let me read it first and then take a stab at translating. Now you will think that I have become a caricature of myself, but Adonai Malach. This is an extremely difficult phrase to translate. It is not clear, and we're going to talk about this at some length, whether Adonai Malach means God is king or God has become king. And from a theological perspective, that really matters. Geut lavesh, lavesh Adonai oz hitazar. God is robed in grandeur. Robed is God, girded with power. Aftikon tevel baltimot. The world is firmly established, it can't or won't be shaken. Nachon kisacha me'az, me'olam ata. Your throne has been established from way back when. From all eternity, you have been. Nasu neharot Adonai, nasu neharot kolam, yisu neharot dochyam. The ocean makes noise, O God. The ocean makes thunder. The ocean expresses its pounding. Mikolot mayim rabim adirim mishpire yam. Adir Bamarom Adonai. Above the thunder of the mighty waters, even more majestic than the breakers in the sea, majestic on high is the Lord. Edotecha ne'emnu me'od, leveitcha na'avakodesh, Adonai le'orech yamim. Your decrees are extremely, trustworthy, enduring. Leveitcha na'ava kodesh, holiness is befitting for your house, O God, for all times. Let me say a few sentences by way of introduction, and then we'll walk through the psalm. What appears to happen in this psalm, I'll complicate this picture a bit later, is that God ascends to the throne after having defeated the forces of chaos, depicted in this psalm as very frequently as the ocean. We've already seen that in the psalm for Sunday. The psalm first declares that God has become king, and then describes the victory that led to God achieving that status of being king. That victory, I think, was primeval. That is to say, at the very beginning of time, rather than through some specific event in Jewish history. It would be interesting to think about the relationship between psalms like this and Shirat Hayam, the Song of the Sea in Exodus 15, which would appear, at least on a surface reading, to say that God became king at the Exodus, right? The Egyptians drown, and then we say, first time God is called king in the Hebrew Bible, Adonai Imloch Leolam Va'ed. Now, this is really not our concern, but it's worth noting that academic Bible scholars for more than a century have been arguing about whether there was in ancient Israel an annual enthronement festival, a festival during which the Lord became God. There I tried to say it carefully. First of all, where Adonai became Elohim. Many scholars think yes, many scholars think no. Other scholars say, even if there was no festival that is particularly about enthronement, it's very likely that these psalms that appear to be about enthronement were used in some liturgical setting, probably on some kind of festival. As I've mentioned before, the idea that there might have been an enthronement festival in ancient Israel is not so crazy, given that one could argue that Rosh Hashanah is in part an enthronement festival. Again, that tension I've talked about multiple times between God is king and God is becoming king, or God will become king. Okay? And yeah, I mean, let me actually just belabor that point for 1 second, because I think it's useful. It feels to me like this psalm is saying, God has become king, and yet God has been king from of old. That is an interesting tension. I do not think you should hand an analytic philosopher these two statements and say, reconcile them. I'm not sure they're reconcilable. But they are interesting, and they both express some core religious intuition that ancient Israelites, and perhaps we have. As I've said multiple times, if God is God, then God is God already. On the other hand, I don't know. I just read the New York Times. God is not God yet. Both of those are very real intuitions, very real sensibilities, you might say. Okay? For those of you who are interested, for whatever inexplicable reason, in my process around studying Psalms, I will just tell you that at the end of verse 1 in my notes, I have written in capital letters, I do not understand this psalm, but we're going to do our best, okay? Now, this psalm is recited on Fridays. That's mentioned in the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah. It concerns creation and is thus presumably connected to Shabbat. More than being connected to creation, Shabbat is the completion of creation, and the subduing and defeat of chaos is the completion of creation. So God subduing the waters and us entering into Shabbat are kind of the same thing. Now, there is an idea among scholars that oftentimes in religion, what is imagined to have taken place at the beginning is alternatively also imagined to take place at the end. So I find it interesting that the Shirim Shel Yom, the songs of the each day, the daily psalm, begin and end with the idea of God subduing chaos and creating the world. And that's because, already in the Hebrew Bible, as I've talked about, you have psalms and other texts that say God subdued chaos and created the world, and other texts that say, oh, really? Could have fooled me. And then we get passages in the prophet Isaiah where he says, in the future, God will subdue chaos. That's Urzeit is Endzeit. The beginning of time is the end of time. I want to just observe that the idea that in the future, the rabbinic idea that God will cut up the Leviathan and feed it to the righteous in the world to come, or, you know, in the days at the end of time, that is this idea that God will defeat chaos. Leviathan is a sea monster. And that's basically a way of saying, poignantly, creation didn't work so great yet. I mean, people behave barbarously. Tsunamis destroy lives. What do you mean God subdued chaos? Chaos is everywhere. And in many ways, as I've talked about many times, one of the core powers of biblical thinking is precisely the admission that that is the case. The refusal to sort of make believe that, oh, that's not true. Everything is wonderful. Like, you really don't have that move. I mean, I guess you do have that move in some texts, but canonically, you really don't have that. Okay, so now to the verses themselves. By the way, sorry, the Septuagint has the following heading: for the day before the Sabbath, when the earth became inhabited. Mizmor le David. Okay. Hashem Malach. As I said already in translating, that means either the Lord is king or the Lord has become king. If the idea is that God is king, then it is an affirmation that God is always from eternity king, which would make sense in that it would go well with the end of verse 2. On the other hand, if it means the Lord has become king, that fits better with the idea that God has just defeated some forces of chaos before which God was not yet king. I hope that that makes some sense. There are other psalms where it seems clear that Hashem Malach means God is king. My own instinct about this psalm is that it means God has become king. Even though we have that statement about being king from all eternity, I just think the idea of God defeating chaos suggests a point of time, a point in time, even if it's primordial time, in which God ascends to the throne, if you will. If you like academic speak, you could say that the difference between these two interpretations is that one would make this a kingship psalm and the other would make it an enthronement psalm. The difference between those two things, I trust, is clear. A kingship psalm is God is king. An enthronement psalm is, hey, let's declare and proclaim God is king. Geut is grander. Robert Alter, who, as I think I've mentioned, is where he really shines, is in these kind of literary observations, points out that there's a possible pun here between the word geut and the word ga'a, which is what waves do. Waves rise, and we're about to hear about waves. This is really, Alter is amazing at this kind of thing, like seeing poetic devices. Lavesh Hashem, God is, sorry. I should have said one other thing. We have something similar in the Song of the Sea, which you have as your first supplemental source. Ashira ladonai ki ga'o ga'a. I will sing to God because God has, I think Alter renders that surged, oh surged, which is very clever, right? Playing with the idea of God being elevated and also with the idea of ga'a and waves. And then Lavesh Hashem, the idea of God being enrobed, is also a royal image. You can look at the beginning of Psalm 104, the Psalm for Rosh Chodesh. Now, just to get the cleverness of this image or the beauty of this image, rather than being enrobed in a robe, right, God is clothed with majesty and power. God's attributes of majesty and power do for him what royal robes do for human kings. That is, they broadcast God's grandeur. It's probably also worth saying that to be girded with geut and oz, with majesty and power, is probably to depict God as a divine warrior. And that is an interesting image that is pervasive in the Bible and that is also queasy making for many moderns. Maybe a topic for another day that we could explore. Verse 2 says, and this is back to that tension, at least as I'm reading this psalm, that God's throne stands firm from the time when God defeated God's mythological enemies. Tikon Tevel, in verse 1, the world is established. Nachon, Kisacha, Tikon and Nachon are the same root, same Shoresh. God's throne is established. The idea is, as we've talked about in several psalms, right, that there is a link between God's sovereignty and God's having made the world ordered and habitable. Is that clear? Right? So the fact that the world is established is what makes it possible for God's throne to be established, or something like that. Or if you want, I mean, in in establishing the world, God also establishes God's throne, something like that. And then in verses 3 and 4, God defeats the forces of the sea. The sea lifted its waves in attacking God, and God, who is the real storm God, decisively and definitively beat it back. Some scholars of the ancient Near East say that it seems like this psalm is actually inspired visually by a thunderstorm on a seashore. That the visual image here is like the waves are going crazy and then it subdues. That's the kind of visuality. Is that a word? But that's the kind of visual image that this psalm is trying to present us with. It's almost like the sea advances on the land. Just to belabor this for a second, in case it wasn't obvious what I meant. The sea advances on the land, right? And then the thunder and lightning come and somehow push the sea back out to sea, if you will. And that is kind of God's defeat of the threateningness of waters. And I've talked about this before, but I'll just reiterate. Water is a very complicated image for religion and maybe for human life in general. On the one hand, water is sustenance. Nimshelu divrei Torah b'mayim, says Shir HaShirim Rabbah, right? The words of Torah are compared to water, right? Water is also the ultimate symbol of chaos. And as I've talked about many times, climate change makes that something we can relate to more and more easily, more and more readily, more and more of the time. Here, I think the psalm is mentioning that there are forces that resist God's rule, but it does not suggest that they pose any real threat to God's power. They're big and powerful, and God says, okay, that's nice. I'm going to put you down now. I do want to mention that there are some scholars who think that the raising of the voice of these psalms is that they are raising their voices in praise rather than combat. I think that is less likely, but it's there. And of course, in verse 3, the streams raising their voices represent a kind of dramatic contrast to the idea that the world has been firmly established and the divine throne has been firmly established. In other words, if you're reading this and you read verses 1 and 2, verse 3 comes as something of a shock. Verse 1, the world is established. Verse 2, God's throne is established. Verse 3, there are chaotic forces that are threatening both. That's, right? It's jarring. Verse 4, the grammar of verse 4 is hard. The structure of the verse, I think, is clear. That is, the waves rise high, but God is seated even higher. I think that's what Mikolot Mayim Rabim Adir Bamarom Adonai. God is more elevated than these strong waters. Mayim Rabim probably doesn't mean, by the way, a great deal of water. It means forceful water, strong water. And there's a kind of poetic beauty here. Here again, Alter notes this, and I think quite beautifully, that there's an almost a bit of suspense in verse 4. That's my term, not his. Is that like, you know, you don't know what's coming. You're hearing about the sound of these powerful waters, you know, the force of the breakers. And then, yeah, but God is higher. God is higher. Just because some people like this kind of thing, and this is the kind of emendation that takes very little work and is plausible, one Bible scholar suggests that this verse would read better grammatically if it read as follows. Mikolot mayim rabim, Adir mi mishpirei yam, adir bamarom Adonai. That is to say, then the sounds of powerful waters above the breakers, above is God. Something like that. You understand? What they're doing is, instead of adirim, they are moving that mem sofit and making it the beginning of the next word. Mem sofit, final mem, sorry. Okay. Now, verse 5. What on earth is verse 5 about? Verses 1 and 2 were about God either being or becoming king. Verses 3 and 4 were about water that threatens, but fear not, because God is high above them. And then verse 5 says, God, your laws are really trustworthy and great. It's just like a weird, it's like a weird burst of being from, right? Like, it's like creation, struggle, dear God, thank you for the mitzvahs, right? I mean, it's a very strange thing. But it's not, I think, and so I want to just sort of propose this, both God's defeat of chaos and God's giving of law are ways of creating and preserving order in the world. Because if you just made the world habitable from natural evil, you would still have human-inflicted evil. So you need to rein in the chaotic forces in the world, and you also need to rein in people. And one of the claims here, to use language that the Bible would not really relate to, is that the natural law and the moral law come from the same source. They are both reflections of the same fundamental rule. Rule meaning ruling, not like a rule. If this doesn't ring a bell, you can look at Psalm 19, which is part of Psukei Dezimra, for another example of creation and law being very closely connected. And in fact, in general, I think a monarch in the ancient world was expected to kind of order his kingdom and to, I guess, legislate so that people had ways of, you know, knew how to live together. So God here is the monarch with a capital M. Okay? I will say there are a few Bible scholars who here take verse 5 to refer not to the laws that God gives people, but rather to God's declaration to the chaotic forces that they must behave themselves. I find that kind of unlikely. Leveitcha na'avak kodesh, holiness is befitting for your house. The Lord's unique status as the one true God makes God's dwelling place a truly unique place, other than any other place, meaning kadosh. Okay? And Leorech Yamim is interesting because we already saw an allusion to God being king from of old. And now we're saying your temple will be worthy of holiness forever and ever. Something like that, I think. Yeah. Okay. Now, I want to just make one observation in concluding, and then we'll take some questions. I think this psalm is a really good example of something that we have to struggle with as, here I'm real, obviously I'm talking very much as Jews who daven, engage with liturgy. The psalm declares something that seems to be completely out of step with reality as we know it. We say on Friday morning and then again on Friday night, God, you have subdued those forces that threaten life, and thus you are king. But then when we leave shul, we have to go pay a shiva call for a kid who passed away, or visit a 35-year-old who's struggling with cancer. There's so much that makes the psalm seem like, what planet is this that we're inhabiting? And all I really want to observe about that is that there are anthropologists who talk about the idea that what liturgy and ritual are meant to do is to create an alternative reality. Like, I forget if it's Clifford Geertz, one anthropologist who says, right, liturgy gives us another world to live in. A world that is not false, or else we couldn't really live in it and mean it, but a world that is not yet reflected in the quotidian day-to-day reality that we inhabit. So I, you know, I ask you the same question I ask many times in classes like this, like, what do you do with this sum? Are you able, and this question asked with zero judgment of any kind, just in case that's not clear, you know, are you able to inhabit even for a moment the world that the Psalms conjure for us? I'll just kind of like underscore one other aspect of this. Forget about the Psalms. Shabbat is almost literally in the Jewish imagination entering an alternative reality. Me'ein olam haba. You say Bo'i kala, come, O bride, and you enter a world that is already perfect. A world that is already perfect. I have a headache, and my kids are driving me crazy. And by the way, the soup is burned, and I don't have a spoon. Right? I mean, what do you mean the world is perfect? I cannot believe so few people laughed at that. Come on, people. You're a tough crowd. But, you know, right? In other words, it's hard. What do you mean the world is redeemed? And yet we try to enter, you know, a kind of me'ein olam haba, a foretaste of what the world will one day be, totally perfect. And ideally, the tension between the world as we inhabit it on Shabbat and the world as we inhabit it 6 days a week is a fruitful tension. It helps us try to create moments of Shabbat on Tuesday, if you will. If you understood what I mean by that, that's great, but perhaps I should explain what I mean by that, right? Which is like create foretastes of the world to come that are not on Shabbat, but are in the midst of our day-to-day difficult reality.